Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 260, Whole Psychiatry with Dr. Robert Hedaya. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I like to say is that, to make a Big Mac, you need the special sauce and the sesame seed bun and the lettuce and the pickle, et cetera. So you got to have the ingredients to make a Big Mac. In the same way, you got to have the ingredients to make neurotransmitters. So you've got to have tryptophan, you've got to have tyrosine, you've got to have B6, you've got to have B12, you've got to have folic acid, you have to have copper, you have to have zinc, and these are basic nutrients that you have to have. And if you don't have them, you're not going to make enough serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Robert Hedaya, talking about the approach he founded, Whole Psychiatry. Robert J. Hedaya, MD, is the founder of the National Center for Whole Psychiatry in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Dr. Hedaya believes that better mental and physical health can be achieved with less medication by correcting bodily systems and getting to the roots of ill health. Using traditional and integrative approaches, Dr. Hedaya assesses digestion, nutrition, immune function, inflammation, detoxification, oxidative stress, hormones, and genetics in every person he evaluates. Although he is a certified psychopharmacologist, through this method, Dr. Hedaya has found that his patients can achieve better physical and mental health with less medication. He's an active member of the Endocrine Society, a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, a former board member of the Suburban Maryland Psychiatric Society, and board certified by the American Boards of Psychiatry and Neurology, Adolescent Psychiatry, and Clinical Psychopharmacology. Dr. Hedaya has been a consultant to the National Institutes for Mental Health and is a clinical professor of psychiatry and clinical psychopharmacology. Dr. Hedaya has been a consultant to the National Institutes for Mental Health and is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University Medical Center, where he teaches courses on psychoendocrinology, affective disorders, and cognitive behavior therapy. He's received the Outstanding Teacher of the Year Award on 3 occasions from Georgetown University Medical Center. He's the author of 3 books, Depression, Advancing the Treatment Paradigm, The Antidepressant Survival Program, and Understanding Biological Psychiatry. He's been featured in the local and national media on multiple occasions and is a frequent, nationally and internationally recognized speaker. He has an active blog on wholepsychiatry.com as well as psychologytoday.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Robert Hedaya, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
I am really happy to have this opportunity to meet with you and to discuss your work. If I recall correctly, your wife is a psychologist and a listener to Shrink Wrap Radio, and she wrote suggesting that you'd make an excellent guest.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. It's interesting to hear from a psychologist who's recommending her husband rather than herself. Evidently she holds you and your work in high esteem. And over the past 40 years or so, there have been a variety of therapies which characterize themselves as holistic. Now, as a physician and a psychiatrist, you founded an approach that you call whole psychiatry. So we'll start in the obvious place. What is whole psychiatry and what necessitated it? And if you want to give us sort of lead in with some of your background and how you evolved in that direction, that would be great, too.
Sure, that's a great question. Well, first, whole psychiatry is an amalgam between traditional psychiatry, which involves diagnosis and psychological assessment and the use of psychopharmacology, as well as the use of alternative methods or methods that really focus on trying to get the body to work. Basically, what I've learned is that the physiology strongly affects the mind. So if someone comes in to see me, I'll spend about 2.5 hours with them. I'll do a physical examination. And what I do is I look at the standard stuff, but then I also look at digestion and I look at the immune system and detoxification and infection and inflammation and hormones and genetics and even epigenetics and biochemistry. And so all of these things enable me to often achieve my goal, which is getting people well with as little medication as possible. And in once we've established what systems and what nodes on a matrix that I use are causing problems, we direct the treatment to those nodes. And sometimes we use nutritional supplements or hormonal or dietary changes or meditation or a variety of things, craniosacral therapy or psychotherapy, you know, and sometimes medication, although, like I said, I try to avoid that. So in answer to the question, how did this come about, it's kind of a story I like to tell because it's really pleasing. It's been an evolution. And it started back in 1985 when I had a woman I was treating who was about 50. And she came to me with panic attacks, which she had never had before. And in taking the history, she had one daughter, and she had a marriage that wasn't so good, and so she was having panic attacks, and her daughter was going off to college. And I thought, well, you know, there's probably like a separation anxiety here, so let me treat her with cognitive therapy, which was at the time cutting edge. And when that didn't work, I said, well, let me try some medication. And so we went through three different medicines. And then a year into the treatment, she paged me on a Saturday night with a panic attack. And I thought, you know, I must be missing something here because panic attacks are pretty straightforward and easy to treat. So I went to the office early Monday morning and I looked at her chart. And I had done a little blood work initially, and I saw in the chart that the size of her red blood cells were a little bit large. So, you know, the normal range was 80 to 100, and she was 101. And when I originally did it, I said, well, it's a little bit out of the range, and I don't even really know what it means anyway, and so I ignored it.
Right.
And then a year later, I said, well, I better look into this. So I looked it up, and sure enough, it turned out to be evidence of a B12 deficiency, and I put her on B12 after doing a little bit of a workup, and immediately with the first injection, her panic was gone. And I was able to look back and say, boy, you know, obviously, what I'm missing things. What else am I missing? So that really started me on a path of the question, you know, why aren't people getting well? Why do we have a revolving door psychiatry? Why is it that every patient comes in with a history of having seen several psychiatrists or psychologists? Why is it that they're on multiple medications now, you know? So the answers gradually came to me through study and through patients. And then in about 1996, after I wrote my first book, I really was on the edge of chronic fatigue syndrome myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that propelled me to start to look at what I could do for myself. And that pushed me into a field called functional medicine. And so I went for training and treated myself and had a full recovery and became very active, mountain biking and fully active, and eventually wrote my second book. And, you know, I started using it with my patients and was astounded with the results. So that's what I've been doing, and I've been teaching people and writing, and that's really my mission.
Wow, that's a great answer, and there's so many places I'd like to hook onto in that answer there. First of all, I just want to underscore that you got curious about, you know, what was going on with that patient and that that 1 point difference in terms of that, you know, detecting that vitamin B deficiency and the difference that made. And it sort of brought to mind my wife's constant complaint about physicians in general that she, that we encounter, is that they seem to lack curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've already got their mind made up about so many things, and they don't kind of have that kind of curiosity that you showed.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, there was a study I read a few years ago. You probably heard of it. Patients walk into the doctor's office, and it's within, I want to say 18 seconds, but let's say within the first minute, that the doctor has already made the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that what I learned in my training was that you have to be able to tolerate uncertainty. So when I was being trained in psychiatry, we would see a lot of patients, but on Wednesdays we had a series of lectures. And at 12 o'clock, the explanation for human psychological or psychiatric problems was a behavioral explanation. And at 1 o'clock, it was a biochemical explanation. And at 2 o'clock, it was a family systems explanation. And at 3 o'clock, it was a psychoanalytic explanation. And, you know, I was, you know, what's going on here? You know, they can't all be right. Yeah. Or they can't all be wrong. So I had to hold the tension, and it was very difficult because you're treating people and kind of like, what tool do I use here? And so I had to hold the tension for about 3 years. Finally, by the end of my training, I was able to integrate them into a model, a psychological model. And it basically what it amounted to was pretty simple. And it's basically you look at a problem and what you see is a manifestation of course, your paradigm, but what kind of lens you use. So if you use a high-powered lens, then you see the biochemistry. If you use a very low-powered lens, you'll see the family. If you use an even lower-powered lens, you'll see the culture, you know, and it really depends on what power lens you use. So what I strive to do is use different powers of lens in every assessment, and so I can attack things from, actually I shouldn't use the word attack, I can work with things using different modalities and different tools. And so that's important. And the other point I want to make is a really important point, which is that if we look at the example I gave of the size of red blood cells and the normal being 80 to 100, and this patient was 101, so I ignored it, which is kind of really how I was trained. And now I realize that, you know, you don't have, it's called the MCV, the size of the red blood cells. You don't have an MCV of 99 one day and you're normal, and 101 the next day and you're abnormal. You know, you don't have a glucose of 99 Sunday night and 101 on Monday morning, therefore you are now diabetic on Monday morning. It's a grayscale. As you move away from what your norm is, you're moving towards illness.
Okay.
That's a perspective that most people, currently modern medicine doesn't have that perspective. You know, you have an illness or you don't have an illness, and they're not really working with the function of the system and diminishing organ reserve. It's kind of like a bank balance. You know, your bank balance deteriorates or diminishes over time, and then when you write a big check, you know, you bounce the check. But if you have a big bank balance, you can afford to take health risks or, you know.
Yeah, does this relate to functional medicine? Because, you know, one of the key components that you mentioned is functional medicine. What is functional medicine, and how does it relate to what you're saying right now?
Well, the non-traditional part of what I'm saying is functional medicine. So functional medicine is a approach to chronic illness, which is really most of what's bankrupting our healthcare system right now. And the approach is one that looks at, it's a dynamic approach. It looks at function. So it's not static. It's not like you're in this box. or you're not in this box. So the analogy I often use with my patients is, let's say you have a car and you want to assess your shock absorber. Well, you can take a ruler or measuring tape and see what the extension is, or you can push on the car, assign a stress to the car, and see what kind of wave pattern you get, and that'll tell you about the functional reserve of the shock absorber. And it's the same thing with our adrenal glands and our gastrointestinal system and our nutritional reserves, et cetera, hormones, et cetera. So functional medicine looks at the function and the reserve of organ systems and body systems and psychological systems, and tries to improve and increase that reserve by treating the underlying metabolic issues that might be getting in the way, as well as what I do is add in the psychological aspect and the social and spiritual aspects.
Okay, well, you raised the question of, you know, the economics of medicine today, which is, of course, driving us all crazy. And so your initial consultation takes 2.5 hours, and you talk about getting the whole picture, which I love, the symptoms, the person, the biology, the psychology, the interpersonal situation, the family, the community, the culture, and spirituality. That's a lot. I would think some psychiatrists would think that such an approach would be unrealistic, especially in today's economy.
Well, I'm fortunate that I can do it. You know, I made a choice when managed care came out in 1991, when physicians were hiring lawyers to be able to sign on to panels, and one of the managed care companies sent me a contract that said, you know, we'll pay you X dollars per hour, we will hold back 20%, we'll pay you at the end of the year the 20% if you've done what we ask, and we'll tell you how many sessions you can treat a patient for. And I just felt, you know, I'm not personally able to do that. I strive to do the highest quality work, and so I'm just going to do the highest quality work I can do. And if I can't do it, if people don't want that, then I will leave medicine. And so I'm fortunate in being able to do that. So I'm trying to practice the best medicine I can. And obviously, it takes a lot of time. And you can easily say that it's not cost-effective, but that's not true. Because if you spend 2.5 or 3 hours with someone, and if you do a thorough workup, and if they implement what you're asking them to implement, that then what happens is not only does their psychological health improve, but their physical health improves, and a result of all of that is that their family system and their work improve as well, because they're more functional, happier people. So the ripple effect and the downstream effect over time makes it very cost effective. But if you take the current model, which is give someone a medicine, basically come in, see the doctor, get a medicine, then what happens is you pay in terms of side effects. So, for example, the psychiatric medications, probably 95% of them cause weight gain and push people into what's called metabolic syndrome, eventually diabetes. That's associated with osteoporosis and cardiovascular disease. So the very treatment actually, over the long haul, whether it's 5 or 15 or 20 years, actually produces the problems we're trying to avoid. So if you take the big picture, it's very cost effective, but it's a different model, and it's more costly up front and much less costly in the long run.
By the way, I'll call your attention to an interesting article in, I think, the current issue of the New Yorker magazine, where they're looking at the writer talks about some pioneering efforts to study the people who are consuming the most in terms of medical services. It's like mm-hmm. they're like 1% or 5% of the people are consuming like 80 to 95% of the resources. And mm-hmm. the traditional insurance company approach to that is, well, let's reduce, you know, the amount of services that we're going to offer people as a way to control that. These people took the reverse approach and said, okay, let's find a way to give these people all the treatment, attention, and care that they need, and focus on them. And they're making an argument that in the long run that will be less expensive. Now, I probably haven't presented the thesis terribly well, but I think you would enjoy reading that article.
Yeah, I think that's my point. And I think, you know, there's a lot of evidence for it. There are some studies that support it, but we really do need a much larger study, or maybe several studies to document it. But I know in terms of my patients that that's what I see.
Yes. And, you know, even just the fact that to have a physician or a medical person spend 2.5 hours with you, that's healing in itself.
It is.
Yeah, it's so rare, and people really crave attention to their situation, to their lives, to their needs. And so that kind of communicates a caring, I think, at a powerful level.
Yeah, well, you know, when I just had a patient that came in Tuesday, that's exactly what she said. She said she was tired. She had been on 4 or 5 medicines for depression and anxiety, and she said, "You know, I go to the doctor. I said, they talk to me for 5 minutes, and they don't even know me, and then they throw a medicine at me, and then she goes home, and either she takes 1 or 2 doses and has side effects, or she doesn't take it, but they keep prescribing it because I looked at her prescription records from the pharmacy, and the doctor kept renewing it every time she'd visit him, and he was an internist. And so the internists, you know, have been trained really by drug companies and managed care companies to assess patients with depression and anxiety and then, you know, use psychopharmacology or referral to a therapist. And they're really, you know, for a lot of people, they're doing a disservice both in the short run and the long run. You know, maybe you've heard of all these warnings, these black box warnings for antidepressants that they can cause suicide.
Yes.
Have you heard?
Yeah, well, particularly with young people, and particularly when people
right.
are first starting to take the antidepressants, they may have as they start to feel re-energized, the theory is that they're feeling good enough now to kill themselves. They have enough energy to do it.
Yeah, and it's that, and it's also an agitation as a result of the medication, sometimes a mixed mania. Now, all of this is avoidable if somebody takes a really careful history and gets collateral history, you know, from mother, father, sister, brother, friend, and then has a relationship established so that they are closely following up how the patient feels. And whether it's a phone call or checking in a week or whatever it is, that's the appropriate care. And without that care, that's what you're going to see. You're going to see suicidal attempts, you know, it's preventable.
Earlier, you had mentioned your own struggle with chronic fatigue syndrome, and I take it you got over that. I'm particularly interested because I have a son who has been wrestling with that for some years. Were you, in fact, able to get over chronic fatigue syndrome?
Yeah, I was. I really became alarmed because first of all, I was told that by a colleague. You know, I didn't really know that much about it, and she said, "Bob, you know, you're on the edge of chronic fatigue syndrome." And I was, that got my attention. And then I did a little research, and then I did some tests on myself, and I saw that one of my white blood cells, called the natural killer cells, were really functioning at a very low level. My adrenal glands were functioning at a low level, and my thyroid was functioning at a low level, and I was getting sick all the time. I mean, very frequent sinus infections. And so I did more research, and then I radically changed my diet and tested myself for a variety of hormones and nutrition. And the one thing I actually left out at that time that I'm dealing now with is mercury. But through that and all of those measures and gradually increasing my activity level, I recovered completely and actually was in better shape than ever. There are some people who in whom that won't work, and we don't really know why, but for a very substantial percentage of people with chronic fatigue syndrome, that does work. And so I think even if the way I look at it is, even if you put all those things into place and the person doesn't get substantially better, then you can go the next step, and there are some immunologists that you can I refer to who can try to work on drugs that are antiviral drugs and things like that. So you kind of get the foundation in place, and then you can go with other steps.
Okay. I noticed that detoxification is a frequent part of your treatment approach. What toxins are you referring to, and how do you, you know, get your patients to detox?
Well, you know, I went to a conference on detoxification about 3 years ago. We spent about 4 or 5 days looking into it. And by the end of the conference, I was pretty sure we should all be dead. You know, it was pretty astounding, you know. But
are you talking about environmental toxins or?
Yeah, I'm talking about environmental toxins and mercury, heavy metals. And I'm not sure if you know, but the National Institute of Health has found over 900, and perhaps the number is now over 1,000, new-to-nature chemicals. And about 200 to 300 of these are found in newborns. And so we have all of these new-to-nature chemicals, some of which are carcinogens, although they say you have to have higher levels to cause that. But there is no way that we will ever know what those things do in a mixture like they're, as they're present in our own body. So the best thing you can do is have support for your liver. You try to strain out your gastrointestinal health. And you try to eliminate heavy metals if you have them in your system, and avoid exposure as much as possible to the chemicals. And it's not really possible to avoid exposure completely, but you can not use pesticides. You can avoid drinking from plastic bottles. Try to use glass, you know, and educate yourself on these things, and you know, do the best you can. But we can't really avoid it. So the main thing is get out what you can get out, and put in good stuff to help your body, particularly your liver, detoxify.
Yes, I'm curious. When you said you should support your liver, what is that? How does one support their liver?
Well, what you do is, I mean, there are a number of nutrients that you use, and it could be anything from alpha lipoic acid to milk thistle to certain amino acids to something called N-acetylcysteine or selenium, you know, they're just the manganese and magnesium. There are many, many things that could go into this kind of approach, but it's easy to do. There are products on the market that will support your liver and enable you to detoxify a lot of these chemicals. And then trying to keep your weight down is really important. And one thing people often do is, let's say you're overweight, 20 pounds, let's just say, and you decide to lose weight. Many of these toxins are stored in your fat cells. They're fat-soluble, so they're stored in the fat. So now if you go on a program to lose weight, then a lot of that fat is released into your bloodstream, and with it, these chemicals. So you're actually getting a toxic dump from your own stores, your fat stores. So very, very important to support your detoxification systems if you're losing weight. That's extremely important and usually not done. You know, you see people go on these fasts, or they go on a severe restriction, calorie restriction, or things like that. It's not healthy from that, you know, toxicity point of view.
Well, that's interesting, because I know I have sort of quotes counterculture friends who periodically will say they're going to detox by going on a fast, by going on a juice fast or some other kind of fast. Is that something that you advocate or not?
Well, I don't. Let's say you have a friend who's very thin, and they do that periodically. I think that's probably fine. But if you have someone who has significant fat stores, if they want to do it, they need to do some kind of detox support at the same time, or else I think you're doing some harm to your body. They may feel better, but mm-hmm. but I think they're doing some harm.
Okay, another area that you lean on or talk about is inflammation. And I recall reading somewhere that inflammation is at the root of a lot of our ills, including aging. And I guess that most of us have pockets of inflammation that are going on kind of all the time. Bring us up to speed on inflammation, if you will.
Yeah, so what I think of infection and inflammation together as one process. So you can have infection and then you will have inflammation. You can just have inflammation without infection, but it's really immune activation is really what we're talking about, the immune system being dysregulated or imbalanced or activated and maybe even parts of it deactivated, but it's the immune system is what we're talking about. So inflammation, when you have an inflammatory stimulus, let's say you get a sinus infection or you get an infection on your skin or a sore throat or something like that, what happens is, or even let's say an infection in your gut, what happens is the chemistry in the body changes. The B cells, the T cells of the immune system get activated and they start secreting these various chemicals. They're kind of like hormones. They travel through the body, and we call them cytokines because they cause some white blood cells to move in the direction of the insult in the body, whether it's, so we'll say it's to your throat. So the cytokines might help the white blood cells go to your throat as a signal. But they do lots of other things. And one of the things they do is they increase free radicals. And free radicals are good because they can kill viruses and bacteria, but they're also bad because they can do harm to the energy-producing functions of the body. So if there's an imbalance there, you might end up having problems with energy. The other thing that inflammation anywhere in the body does is it changes the brain's chemistry. So let me mention an experiment that was done. It's really fascinating. What they did is they took 20 normal male volunteers for this experiment. Now, I always thought it's kind of funny to call them normal male volunteers because anyone normal wouldn't volunteer for this study. But they were college students, and I guess they needed the money. So what they did is they took a very, very low dose of something called lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. LPS is like the envelope of bacteria, and it's the part of the bacteria that makes you sick. So when you get a cold infection and you feel sick, it's because the LPS is kind of activating all these things that make you feel sick. So they took a very, very, very low dose of LPS, and they injected it through intravenous to these men. And then they watched over 10 hours their blood pressure and their pulse and their cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and they tested their mood and their anxiety and their memory. And what they found is when the hormones of the immune system, these cytokines, went up, their anxiety went up, their memory performance went down, and their depression went up. And this was a tight correlation. And it turns out that there are many, many studies now that link so many illnesses to activation of the immune system, from Alzheimer's disease to Parkinson's disease to, of course, chronic illness like diabetes to osteoporosis, you know, cardiovascular disease. All of the chronic illnesses pretty much, or let's say most of the chronic illnesses, have inflammation as the pathway that causes damage. Now, what triggers the pathway and where that damage occurs can vary you know, from illness to illness. So inflammation is really critical. In fact, if we talk about Alzheimer's disease for a second, there were 10 large studies that were done on people who had autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. And in these studies, these people would take high doses of things like Aleve and Advil and ibuprofen, those non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, very high doses to treat their arthritis or whatnot. And investigators noticed by accident that in these populations, very, very few people got Alzheimer's disease. It was so remarkable that NIH started a study to actually prospectively test this hypothesis. Basically, they were going to treat people with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories at high doses and see if the incidence of Alzheimer's disease was lower. But what happened is the medication that they used was withdrawn by the FDA, and there were some questions about the study design, so it never actually happened. But I think there's sufficient evidence to say that Alzheimer's disease, whatever the insult is, the pathway is inflammatory. And there's a very good evidence that by reducing inflammation, you could at least delay it or maybe even prevent it.
Well, what would you recommend in terms of a prophylactic approach to prevent, to lowering the level of inflammation in one's body generally?
What the approach would be, first of all, figure out if you have any infections, subtle infections. So that could be you have a root canal and you had it 5 years ago. Well, you could have an infection there. You wouldn't know it because you don't have any nerves there. So that would be one thing. And then you would look maybe for other infections, say Lyme disease or Bartonella or things like that, chronic sinusitis, exposure to mold or toxins in your environment, things like that. So the first thing I do is I take a history to look, see if there's evidence in terms of those things and inflammation. Then I do some blood work to see if there are markers in the blood of inflammation. And then I eliminate those problems and see if the markers come down. The second thing I do is I look at the gut, because the gut, 70% of your immune system, some people say 60, some people say 80, but the vast majority of your immune system and the insults to your immune system come through your gut. Every meal you eat, all the bacteria and the parasites and whatnot in your gut are challenging your immune system all the time. So the gut, making sure that the gut is functioning properly, is critical to dealing with inflammation and even psychiatric disorders like mood disorders and OCD and things like that. So I look at the gut carefully with a stool test, there are a variety of tests, and then I correct what's going on there by correcting, giving the proper supplements, changing the diet. And then when we've done that, we can often bring the inflammation down as well. And those are the major approaches. In addition to that, you can take antioxidants, whether it's, you know, pycnogenol or resveratrol, vitamin C. You know, there are so many antioxidants available. Don't over-exercise. And I think that, you know, that's a very good approach that will help most people.
Okay. Yes, I read about some of the things that you've mentioned in your blog. You have a very interesting and readable blog. And one of the things that you talked about there was nutritional deficits may play a role in mood disorders. What's been your experience in regard to that?
Well, I guess what I like to say is that, you know, to make a Big Mac, you need the special sauce and the sesame seed bun and the lettuce and and the pickle, etc. So you got to have the ingredients to make a Big Mac. In the same way, you got to have the ingredients to make neurotransmitters. So you've got to have tryptophan, you've got to have tyrosine, you've got to have B6, you've got to have B12, you've got to have folic acid, you have to have copper, you have to have zinc, you know, and these are basic nutrients that you have to have. And if you don't have them, you're not going to make enough serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine. So that's step one, is to make sure that the diet is balanced. Step two is make sure the intestine is functioning so that, you know, you can digest the food and absorb the nutrients. Step three is to test to see if you have adequate nutrients, and if you don't, replace them. And then, you know, step four would be to eliminate the inflammation, because inflammation from anywhere changes the chemistry in the brain so that you have less serotonin and you have more dopamine and you have more glutamate. And glutamate causes anxiety, and it can actually destroy, in high doses, it can destroy nerve cells. So as you can see, as I talk, everything's connected to everything.
Yes.
And so that's why I call it whole psychiatry. And I like to reserve a little place in the definition of whole psychiatry for not knowing, because there's always going to be a lot that we don't know, and we have to be open to that.
Yeah, in fact, you wrote that it's essential that the practitioner of whole psychiatry be able to tolerate ambiguity and be open to new learning.
Yeah, I think that's true. And what I see, you know, I've been trying to train psychiatrists in this for probably 10 years. And what I see is, I think it's human nature. People have trouble tolerating uncertainty, and they're comfortable with what they know. And, you know, they just as soon refer someone out than try to figure things out. And I'm not saying you shouldn't refer someone out, but you should really try to expand your knowledge. I mean, I think, you know, you can't build a house with a screwdriver. You know, you have to have a lot of tools. And you can't help someone improve their health with two tools, you know, with psychotherapy and medication. You have to have a lot of tools. And it just seems to be the way people are. They like what they know, and as long as they're comfortable and they're not getting uncomfortable, they don't really, you know, try to learn too much, you know.
Yeah, I resonate to what you're saying about holding the tensions, because I'm something of a Jungian in terms of a psychological orientation, and Jung certainly, and the Jungians kind of beat that drum quite a bit, to that a marker of health is to be able to tolerate all of the ambiguities of existence, rather than latching on to a sense of certainty by clinging to one thing or another.
Yeah, and I would say there's a, you know, it takes a certain kind of mentality, and it's probably like a lot of the Jungians, you know, you're open to the mystery, and you're open to not knowing, and you're curious, and as opposed to the kind of people the medical schools choose, most of them are people who are great at memorizing facts.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's a different kind of person, and we need those kind of people, but we definitely need people who are curious and willing to explore and accept things that may break their paradigm.
Yes. Now, are you a lonely prophet crying in the wilderness, or have you been, or have you been able to persuade other psychiatrists to join you in this approach?
Well, you know, 10 years ago, I teach at Georgetown, and I teach with a friend of mine who's really a traditional psychiatrist, and we've been teaching this course on mood disorders since 1985. And about 10 years ago, one of the residents asked him, said, "Dave, what do your colleagues think of Dr. Hedaya?" He said, "Well, he's out on a limb, but we're all slowly crawling out there towards him."
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, and I would say that I see a change now. I was just asked to talk to the Washington Psychiatric Society and gave a talk in September for a few hours, and people were curious, and I think I see the beginning of a change coming, and I think that's because, there's a natural rhythm in medicine, which is about every 50 years the paradigm changes, and B, because the current treatments really, they cause a lot of problems and they don't work that well. And it's not to say they don't work at all. I mean, there are plenty of people who do benefit from the traditional approach, but I would say, the studies clearly show that 2/3 of people, for example, with depression don't respond to medication and therapy, or only partially respond, and that doesn't even take into account the side effects. So our model is sorely in need of updating. And the other thing I'd like to add is that we often think, well, modern medicine is really based in science, but the facts are that most of there's a lot of publicity now in the medical circles to the fact that most of the research that's been published, the clinical research, meaning clinical trials on people, is biased. And the drug companies and the publications don't like to publish trials that show that things aren't working. Everyone wants to find something that worked. So that's what gets published. So, in fact, what doctors are reading is a very biased literature, and now what they're showing is that something that seems to work in the beginning, if you follow the results over time, it doesn't seem to really hold up statistically, and that's something that crosses all bounds, all the areas of science. So what I like to think that I'm doing is trying to work with really more time-tested things, good diet, good nutrients, good air, good thoughts, good relationships, like basics.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, there's also a lot of new evidence in psychology, supporting some of those things that you just mentioned. Now, you suggested that practicing psychology without functional medicine is tantamount to malpractice. And just to do my due diligence, I don't mean to blindside you here, but I went on Wikipedia to look up functional medicine to see what they might have to say about it. And the article there reported on a Dr. Jeffrey Bland, citing him as the founder of the Institute for Functional Medicine, and that he had two companies that the FTC went after, and he got fined $45,000 for making false claims in regard to a weight loss product. So I have to ask you to comment on that if you have anything to say.
Yeah, sure. Well, I know Jeff Bland. We're not friends or anything like that. But I've heard him speak, and he was actually one of my teachers early on. And this guy is brilliant. I mean, he's got an encyclopedic mind that's pretty astounding. He has made a lot of money on his medical food products, and the money that he made went into establishing the Institute for Functional Medicine. And so I think without that money, he could not have established the teaching programs. So I think he put it to a lot of good. And then what happened is he split off the Institute for Functional Medicine, and it's a nonprofit organization. Then he went off on his own. Now, in terms of the FTC, I'm not aware of it, but what you're saying, but I'm not surprised. I don't know what his claims were, I know his integrity, and I think that probably, this would be my guess, but I don't know for certain, probably his claims were based on biochemistry and biochemical preclinical studies and extrapolation of results. And, I like that kind of research because I feel it's much less biased than the clinical research, which, you know, has been now shown. You know, our journals are full of poorly done studies, poor statistical analysis, and results that are not replicable, and the studies that don't show much or show negative results are kept out. So, you know, when they say, you know, you have proposed something that's not provable or not supportable, you know, I think the FTC needs to look and use a broader lens to look at it. That's the state of medicine. Medicine now is a religion. Science is a religion. It's not what we think it is. And the established ideas change rapidly. Now, I'm not saying you have appendicitis, don't get the surgery. You know, sure you get the surgery, you know. But heart bypass, for example, is 50% of people who have heart bypass develop some cognitive dysfunction afterwards. And it's not shown to extend life, although it is shown to improve and reduce pain. But it's just not what we think it's cracked up to be.
Yes, and it, as you indicated earlier, it's very much influenced by money from big pharma and by political considerations within the professional associations and so on.
Yeah, we have the same problem in medicine that we have in politics. You know, the corporate interest, you know, rules the day. And it's a big, big problem in the society, really.
Well, what if one of my listeners wanted to consult with somebody who is more or less like you, who would spend a lot of time with them and take this functional approach? Is there some resource place that they could go to find a practitioner in their area?
Yeah, they can go to the Institute for Functional Medicine online. Just Google them, and there's a tab that says, you know, find a practitioner, and you put your zip code in. And, you know, you find somebody 10 to 50 or 100 miles from you. And I think the only caveat I would say is, you know, if there are a few that you can choose from, you know, check them out, because instead of treating myself, I wanted to find a functional medicine person who would treat me, take care of my health, you know, instead of me being my own doctor. And it's been difficult because some functional medicine doctors, you know, are practicing better, perhaps, than their colleagues, but they're not fully trained. So the Institute for Functional Medicine is actually starting to institute an accreditation so that people who practice functional medicine have to live up to a standard. But at this point, I think you need to just check them out and see how thorough they are. And so it's not that everyone who practices is great, you know, so you still have to do your due diligence.
Okay. Well, you know, this is probably a good place for us to wrap it up. So, Dr. Robert Hedaya, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks very much, David. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Robert Hedaya. It's nice to know that there are such dedicated psychiatrists out there who are willing to take such time and care to understand the whole person. That certainly makes a lot of sense to me. I don't think I've ever had a physician spend 2.5 hours doing a workup on me. I have to say that sounds like a treat. And I also very much appreciate his philosophy of not drawing premature conclusions, trying to keep an open mind, and trying to use minimum medication. His observations about medicine not being truly scientific echoes the recent conversations that you heard between Jerry Trumbull and me on the last couple of podcasts. Personally, I still cling to some bias of wanting a scientifically trained doctor. I tend to have a guarded response to much of what flies under the banner of alternative medicine. With someone like Dr. Hedaya, though, I'd feel I'm getting the best of both worlds. If you're interested to learn more about Dr. Hedaya and the whole psychiatry approach, you can find more information at his website, wholepsychiatry.com, as well as his blog on psychologytoday.com.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Last time I started out this segment saying how my heart goes out to those in Christchurch, New Zealand, and those in the Middle East trying to shake off authoritarian regimes. Well, my heart still goes out to those people, but now we have to add those in Japan who've suffered such a terrible tragedy of earthquake, tsunami, and damaged nuclear reactors. I can't in good conscience make a pitch for donations to Shrink Wrap Radio when there's so many out there in dire need of your assistance. Personally, I've donated money through the Red Cross, and I encourage you to channel any donations you can afford to the suitable agency of your choice. Also, I have to say that these earthquakes have given my wife and me pause for thought. It would be very challenging for us to uproot from local family and friends at this point in our lives, but we live on an earthquake fault line that is part of what geologists refer to as the Ring of Fire. So we're holding our breath, so to speak, and we'll see. By the time you hear this, I believe there will be a new interview on my other series at wisecounselpodcast.com, and that interview will be with Michael Edelstein, Ph.D., on rational emotive behavior therapy. Dr. Edelstein may be the primary exponent of that approach since the passing of Albert Ellis, and having seen Ellis in action as a graduate student, I must say that Dr. Edelstein's voice and delivery are true to his mentor. I almost felt like I was speaking with Albert Ellis himself. Those of you who've been enjoying my recent conversations with Jerry Trumbull will be happy to know that we have recorded the promised third episode. However, I've got a couple more interviews with other folks before that one comes up in the rotation. While I'm not asking for direct contributions on this episode, I do want to remind you that you can save yourself some money by using our discount codes of our affiliate advertisers at ShoeBuy.com, ForInkJets.com, and AngiesList.com. Look for the links on our site at ShrinkWrapRadio.com, which will take you to the discount codes. Everybody needs shoes and needs new shoes from time to time, so remember that ShoeBuy.com carries just about every brand you've ever heard of and at a substantial savings. I always felt nervous about buying shoes online. What if they don't fit? Well, ShoeBuy.com takes the worry out of that because they allow you to ship any shoes back that don't fit for free. You can either exchange them for ones that do fit or get your money back, no questions asked. Unfortunately, I don't have any new transcripts to announce. Please contact me if you'd be interested in being a volunteer transcriber. So thanks for being a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, and please spread the word to bring others into the fold. And I'll do my best to continue to surprise you with abundant and varied content.
Hi, this is Brian Johnson, philosopher and CEO of Entheos, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Brian Johnson, who I'm happy to announce will be my guest on our next episode. More about that in a bit. But first, let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from longtime listener Rick, who sent me an update of his graduate school plans. And Rick writes, "Hey, Dave, I just wanted to let you know that I decided not to go to the social work route because it just didn't fit who I am. So I reverted back to my original path of obtaining my PhD in psychology, which in turn has led me to the last phase of my admission process at CSPP/Alliant University this coming Friday. Since I do well in interviews and the rest of my admissions packet looks very good, I'm feeling optimistic that I will be accepted. David, you have had a lot to do with the choices I've made over the last several years, and I just wanted to let you know where I am in my life, and thank you for being a part of it. I can't believe you aren't doing a show on NPR yet. Your skills as an interviewer are clearly at that level. That notwithstanding, take heart that your work is helping lots of folks like me. Sincerely, Rick. Well, Rick, thanks so much for your steadfast support and encouragement. And I feel confident that Alliant University will recognize your sterling talents and unrelenting motivation. And meanwhile, I'll still be waiting to hear from NPR. Next, we hear from Joseph Pentany, a licensed professional counselor in Houston, Texas, and one of our regular financial donors and longtime listener who writes, Dr. Dave, I'm a therapist practicing a mindfulness-based therapy, DBT, and I'm starting to be a big fan of ACT. You interviewed Steve Hayes a while ago, and I would love to hear an interview with Russ Harris, author of The Happiness Trap and ACT Made Simple. When I heard the interview with Steve Hayes, I found ACT very intriguing, but did not end up reading any of his books. When I got ready to buff up on ACT, I heard that Russ Harris might be a better choice by a friend who is an actual ACT therapist and has read Hayes. I tore through Happiness Trap and started ACT Made Simple. Russ Harris seems easygoing and funny. I bet y'all would get along. I know you prefer the requester to look up the email contact info of the requested person, so here's what I found. And then he gave me some contact information for getting in touch with Russ Harris. And finally, Joe concludes, and thank you so much for all of the fine interviews you've already done. So thank you, Joe, for that. And if I recall correctly, I believe I have sent off an invitation to Russ, and I think he has accepted. I think we just need to firm things up. Now, here's the last one. This one was a comment from Lorna in the comments area for episode number 258, Revolution and the Quest for Happiness in the Middle East, with my graduate school friend Doug Davis. And Lorna writes, I really enjoyed this interview. I traveled a bit in Egypt and was very impressed with Egyptian hospitality and generosity, particularly outside of the main tourist areas. I've had a bit of a fascination for Arabic music and dance for some time, so I've been very concerned with the way people in the Middle East, particularly Muslim people, have been depicted in the media. This interview with a man who so clearly likes and respects people from Middle Eastern nations was like a balm. Thanks. And thank you, Lorna, for that feedback. That felt like a very important and timely interview to me, and I'd hoped to get more feedback on it than I did, so I really appreciated yours, because that situation is still ongoing. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows, as Lorna did, in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, or voicemail on my phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Robert Hedaya, MD, for giving us the lowdown on whole psychiatry. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with serial entrepreneur, spiritual seeker, and life philosopher Brian Johnson. Brian has created a website called Philosopher's Notes, and he's a very inspirational guy. If you could use some inspiration, we'll look forward to your joining us. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.